Monitor now invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, winner of every major award in its field, a public affairs presentation of NBC News. Today's guest will be the leader of Britain's Conservative Party, Mr. Edward Heath. We'll bring you today's program in a moment.
On behalf of Bob and Ray's campaign for a transistor radio in every home, this is award-winning reporter Wally Ballou at Professor Matthew E. Pulsifer's Computer Center. And what are you working on, Professor?
We've received some amazing figures from a group of radio people, and they'd like us to illustrate the figures with colorful comparisons so that the figures might be more easily understood.
What are the figures?
There were 31 million new radios sold last year, bringing the total in the United States to 242 million, or 25% more radios in this country than people.
Amazing.
Certainly is. Oh, here come the comparisons. If all the radios in America were loaded into freight cars, it would make a train long enough to stretch from Chicopee, Massachusetts to Berwyn, Illinois.
Here's another one. If all the radios were put in one place and turned on at the same time, they'd make a noise loud enough to be heard in Lima, Peru.
Now listen to this one. If all the radios of the United States were dumped into the Grand Canyon, it would fill it halfway up and make quite a mess, too.
Professor, what does it all mean?
Darned if I know.
We all love our country. It's the most beautiful country in the world. Let's keep America beautiful. Doesn't it make you fighting mad when people throw trash and litter all over our streets and roadsides, our parks and beaches and waterways? You bet it does. So carry a litter bag in car or boat. Hold everything for the proper receptacle. Litter is an eyesore. It's a threat to health, costs, tax dollars too. Every litter bit hurts you. Keep America beautiful. Now, meet the press. Today's guest is Mr. Edward Heath, leader of Britain's Conservative Party. Our panel consists of Lawrence E. Spivak, producer and permanent panel member, Henry Brandon of the London Sunday Times, Max Frankel of the New York Times, and Edwin Newman of NBC News. Our moderator, Bryson Rash of NBC News.
We have the first questions now from Mr. Lawrence E. Spivak, the permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Heath, after the defeat of the Conservative Party in the last election, you were quoted as saying the Tory Party is changing and will continue to change. Has there been any big change yet?
Yes, I think there have been considerable developments. As far as policy is concerned, we have already developed policy a great deal since the election defeat of 1964. In the House of Commons, I've reorganized the shadow cabinet and made it much smaller. We had 70 members altogether on our front bench. I've now brought them down to 23. And we're now starting to reorganize the panel of candidates for the future and also the constituency organization, that is, the voting areas for our members.
In terms of policy, what do you consider the most significant change that has taken place in the Tory Party?
In questions of policy, we've really set out five major points. The first is on the economy, to emphasize much more a high-wage, low-cost economy in which we do away with restrictions in trade unions. Secondly, ways of dealing with wildcat strikes. Thirdly, the social services, that as we become more affluent, people should contribute more themselves. Fourthly, a great housing program. And fifthly, the clear declaration that we want to become a member of the European Economic Community, the common market.
Mr. Heath, General de Gaulle seems to believe that Europe is too dependent upon the United States. Do you think England is too?
We have criticized the present British government for becoming too dependent on the United States. I want to make this absolutely plain, that this is not in any way anti-American. For us to say in Britain, we think that Britain ought to stand as much as possible on its own feet inside the Western Alliance, is really something which I believe is not only healthy for Britain, but also healthy for the United States, who are our best friends.
You think, then, Great Britain today is too dependent on America. Would you tell us in what way?
I think, for example, in the last few months in which we've become more dependent on the United States for aircraft supply and production is one particular example.
Would you say that Harold Wilson's government is any more dependent upon America than Winston Churchill's or Harold Macmillan's or Alec Douglas Hume's?
Well, we have a tradition that when we're abroad, we don't criticize our government as such. I've stated what we said during the election. But I think, as a matter of fact, yes, that is the case.
I'm not asking for criticism, just
no.
a fact.
Yes, that is a fact.
Okay. Now, Mr. Heath, there has been criticism in Great Britain of our policy in Vietnam. Would you say that the British government agrees with our policy today?
My understanding of the British government is that they fully support American policy in Vietnam. There has been some criticism in their left wing. As far as we are concerned in the Conservative Party, we also have given general support to the American policy.
Will you give us your own opinion of our policy in Vietnam?
Well, that's a very wide question indeed, isn't it?
Do you yourself support our policy?
I do, as leader of the Conservative Party. I said we give general support to the American administration for their policy in Vietnam.
We'll continue the questioning now with Mr. Brandon.
Not long ago, you advocated a meeting between General de Gaulle and President Johnson. Now you've talked to both of them. Do you still think that it would be useful and desirable?
Yes, I do. But of course, one has got to choose the right moment for it. I fully understand the preoccupations of the President. I was asked at a press conference during the election whether I thought this would be a good thing, and I always think that meetings between the heads of states is a good thing, provided you do it at the right time.
Do you think that the integrated NATO, which General de Gaulle now opposes, is a hindrance, or would it help towards the unity of Europe?
Well, I think that the integration of NATO is necessary in order to deal with the conditions of modern warfare. You can, of course, have a debate about this, but I think one has not got to be careful not to over-exaggerate the degree of integration which exists in NATO. I don't know about here in the United States, but certainly in Britain, some people imagine that it's integrated almost down to the lowest forms of command. This, of course, is not the case. It's integrated at the highest echelons. And as far as helping the unity of Europe is concerned, I don't think it's necessarily connected with economic developments.
Would you more define what you mean by integration at a higher and lower level?
Well, I'm thinking of integration in that you have a commander of one country with very high-level commanders directly under him, but it doesn't go down to regimental level, brigade level, even divisional level.
Mr. Frankel.
Mr. Heath, there's an impression here that President de Gaulle's basic ambition is simply to drive the United States out of Europe. Do you think that's a correct impression?
I don't think that is a correct impression, no. But certainly as far as we are concerned in Britain, it isn't the case.
Could you tell us what you think he is up to?
President de Gaulle?
Yes.
Well, I think that he has, first of all, in mind the status of the French forces. I think he's greatly concerned about that. And I think his philosophy is that a nation's forces don't really respond to the nation's needs unless they feel that they are responsible for the state of the nation and its defense. I think that's his first objective.
Though there are some differences between Britain and France, clearly, on NATO questions, you both are seeking a kind of independence from the United States in having your own nuclear forces. Do you think it is wrong of the United States to look in the long range to driving all of the European countries out of the nuclear business?
Well, my belief is that we were right at Nassau, the arrangement which Mr. McMillan negotiated with President Kennedy, that we would contribute our nuclear forces to the general NATO defense. We would only keep them in case of dire national peril. I think that is justifiable. And I perfectly understand if General de Gaulle wants to do that with the French force.
Why do you need any nuclear weapons? Why do you or France or the Germans conceivably need nuclear weapons? Is it that you do not trust American support in case of emergency?
I think we've all had experience in the times of war. You find yourself in emergencies which may not have been foreseen, and every nation has really got the right to take the necessary measures to deal with that sort of emergency. Now, of course, I've always looked at it in a rather wider sense, which is that we've got the Atlantic Alliance, and that in it we ought to have two major partners, the United States and a united Europe. And I believe that this is would be a healthy balance between the two sides of the Atlantic. Now, if you're going to do that, then you would have some development in nuclear weapons in a united Europe.
Why doesn't Europe spend more time and energy on creating this union and then worry about giving it the nuclear strength of which you speak? Why should France and Britain and conceivably Germany head off in their own directions with nuclear programs?
Well, there are two answers to that. First of all, Europe has spent an immense amount of time and energy in trying to become united. I spent some 2 years myself in trying to negotiate Britain into the common market in order that we should have a wider European unity. And secondly, as far as Britain is concerned, of course, the nuclear already exists. And therefore, it's not a question of, first of all, getting a European unity and then moving on to the nuclear. As far as we are concerned, we were one of the original participants.
Mr. Newman.
Mr. Heath, you said in answer to a question from Mr. Spivak that as leader of the Conservative Party, you gave general support to the United States administration and therefore to the American position in Vietnam, which seemed to me a very lukewarm and rather grudging support. Is that the impression you intended to leave?
Not in the least, no. When I say general support, what I'm saying is that there may be particular tactical matters on which there can well be justifiable debate between military experts in both countries. That is what I had in mind, but as far as when I say general and broad support, then that means on the policy as a whole.
You are not disquieted by the position in which the United States finds itself in Vietnam?
Well, this is a horrible war. Everybody recognizes that, and I think nobody more than the people of the United States and the members of the administration. And the problems, I think this is the most difficult problem which any country has had to handle or any government has had to handle since the end of World War II in 1945. And of course, with a problem of that scale and difficulty, you will have some differences of opinion about the way it's handled, but that doesn't in any way alter the general approach.
Are you aware of any disruptive effect on the Atlantic Alliance by the Vietnam War, by the American part in it?
I don't think so, no.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Heath, one of your leading papers, the Manchester Guardian, in a front page story the other day said, and I quote, "If uninhibited, the Prime Minister would probably say that American policy on Vietnam has been wrong on almost every count." Is that a fair statement, or is that just the Manchester Guardian's?
Well, you're asking me two things there. First of all, exactly what is the Prime Minister's private view, which I don't know. And secondly, is the Manchester Guardian right in describing it in this way and saying that that is a general approach? It certainly doesn't apply as far as we in the Conservative Party are concerned, and I don't think it applies to the great majority of people in Britain.
Well, there have been press reports in this country, too, that a majority of both Labour and Conservative members of Parliament have basic misgivings about American policy.
No, I don't accept that.
You don't accept that at all?
I don't even accept it for the Labour Party. I don't think there's a majority of the Labour Party which have got misgivings.
Now, after your return from a trip to South Asia and Southeast Asia, you favored taking every possible step to secure a negotiated settlement and that this should be the basis, you said, of British policy. Is there anything you think that Great Britain can do to help bring about a negotiated settlement now?
I don't believe that a negotiated settlement is possible, whether it's negotiated directly by the administration or with help from outside, through the United Nations, whatever means may be adopted, until the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese realize that they cannot win. Then I think there will be a situation in which a negotiation in some form or other will be possible. And what we in Britain can do when that moment arises is to work with the other co-chairman, the Soviet Union, in order to try to bring about a conference in which those concerned can take part to get the settlement.
You're saying that at the present time you think that your government can do very little to bring the parties to the conference table.
I think that's so, yes.
Mr. Brandon.
There have been indications lately that anti-Americanism is rising among British businessmen and industrialists due to the dominance of American economic power. Now, they are quite an influential segment of the Conservative Party. I was wondering how it affects your party and your own policies.
I don't believe there's any anti-Americanism in our party. And I wouldn't have said that there was very much in British business. What they do realize is that it's a tremendous task competing with the industrial power of the United States. The economy is so much larger than ours. It has very high quality of management. It's an entirely free enterprise economy with immense drive. It's got all the resources of modern technology. Now, we haven't got that. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why I want to have a larger European market. That will then give us the base on which, given a bit of time, we can develop our own technology.
But how would you develop the bigger competitive units in Europe that could compete with the United States?
Well, it's beginning to happen in the common market itself, of course. That's got a market of 160, 175 million people. If we were in it, and if other countries of the European Free Trade Association were in it or associated with it, that would give us a market of round about 250 million people. Now, as soon as you get a market of that size without any tariff barriers in it, for example, here, no tariff barriers between the states, but just one large market, then you will find industry itself forced by the pressure of events to move towards larger units. And once they get the larger units, they get the larger resources for research and development, and then they can get to work on the new technology.
You're not thinking of common projects like the Concorde?
Well, the common projects help, but you see, a common project produces a particular problem of decision-making. You have two separate firms, and at each level they have to cooperate in order to make decisions. And if there is a difference of view, it comes finally to the boards of the two companies, and then finally becomes a political one between the two governments. Well, this at least means using up precious time. If you're really going to have effective decision-making with the latest technology, you've really, I think, got to do it through a unity. And that only comes about when you've got a unified market. Mr. Frankel.
Mr. Heath, we hear much here these days that Europe is becoming isolationist, that she is not as concerned as the United States with the worldwide commitments in the Far East and other parts of the world. Britain, of course, has been an exception to that. Is Britain, in moving closer to Europe, also becoming more isolationist in this sense?
I don't believe that Europe is isolationist, and I don't believe that Britain, in its broad outlook, is isolationist. I may sometimes at home criticize my own government for saying they're taking steps which I think reflect an insular approach, but I don't think as a country we are isolationist in that sense. Well, now, I just say this, that the European powers have had to go through a period of very great contraction of world responsibilities because of the development of independence of so many countries. Now, this has been a long and hard and painful road for everybody to follow. And I think it's quite natural that some of them should have a period of revival, of regaining strength and their balance and so on. This is true, I think, of the Netherlands and the Dutch Empire, certainly of the French and the French Empire, the Belgians and the Belgian Empire, and true also of ourselves to a considerable extent. But if you come to take the criteria of aid in the rest of the world, for example, well, the French are doing more in aid in various forms than we are in Britain or you are in the United States, proportionately.
Now, if it is not to be isolationist, what do you think Europe's interests in the world beyond will be? Primarily in rapprochement with the Soviet Union and communist part of Europe, or new forms of economic interests in the former colonial areas? What do you think will be the primary thrust of European world interest?
Well, one of the main thrusts at the moment is economic in the developing countries. But the primary thrust must always be the maintenance of the freedom and the independence of Europe itself. Now, if this means at the same time that we can work along with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Socialist Bloc, so much the better. And I'm sure that nobody wants it more than the American people as well. We don't want to continue a state of cold war so long as we can reach a settlement.
Do you see anything on the agenda of conceivable negotiations with Moscow to stabilize Europe finally?
I don't on the immediate agenda, no. I must be quite frank about that. I think while the Vietnamese war is going on, it's very difficult to make further progress in that direction. Mr. Newman.
Mr. Heath, you said a few minutes ago that you'd like to see Britain stand on her own feet within the alliance. I lived in England for 8 years, and I used to hear that from British politicians, if I may say so, at least 3 times a week, and I think it's still going on. What do you mean by that? The last time Britain stood on her own feet within the alliance was Suez, which didn't work out very well. So what do you really have in mind?
Well, as a matter of historical accuracy, we weren't on our own feet. It was a Franco-British action. What I mean is that, as I've explained, that we should work in a wider European context to make our economy more efficient and more effective. We should try and develop our own technology and not rely solely on the United States for the supply of technological information as a result of all the original work done over here. Now, of course, this affects so many different spheres. It affects the normal industrial sphere. It also affects space. We have been taking part in ELDA, which we created, the European Launcher Organization, and ESRO, which is a space research organization. I hear now that the British government is to withdraw from the European Launcher Organization. This, to me and to my colleagues who created it, is a matter for regret. And of course, there's so much fallout in different spheres in space as well, all sorts of developments of electronics, miniaturization, medicine. And if we rely solely on the United States, we have no part in it ourselves. We have no incentive to the people we train in the sciences and in the technologies to stay and work with us.
Are you not given considerable difficulty by the fact that you require American support over financial matters to protect the pound, which imposes restrictions on your policies elsewhere, especially foreign policy?
Well, the state of the pound, if the pound has to be supported, that, of course, in any case, is bound to impose restrictions on domestic policy. If the IMF helps any country, then, of course, that is the case.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Heath, there's been concern in some quarters that President de Gaulle may sign a non-aggression pact with Russia on his upcoming visit. Do you see that as a possibility?
You mean a non-aggression pact between France and the Soviet Union? It is, I suppose, a possibility, yes.
What effect do you think something of that kind would have upon the NATO military organization?
I don't think it would have any effect on the 14.
You don't think that it would really lead to NATO's complete disintegration?
I don't think so, no.
Completely out?
I don't think so, no.
Mr. Brandon?
Do you think that General de Gaulle's concept of Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals is a realistic one?
Well, it's a vision of General de Gaulle that Europe should go forward again to a sort of unity which it once had, in which the barriers are broken down. I don't think that in the immediate future this is likely to come about.
But you think it might come about? You, as the foremost European in England today, do you think that this is a possibility?
Well, if one thinks in the very long term, it is possible to conceive that the Eastern Socialist states would move away from a state-controlled economy into a more liberal economy. There are signs in Poland wanting to become a member of the GATT or take part in the GATT. There are signs in Romania. But this has come about after nearly 20 years, and it's still a very gradual development. One's got to look quite a long way in the future before you can see a unity of that kind economically, or defense-wise, or politically.
Mr. Frankel.
Mr. Heath, given the present governments of France and Britain, what is a good bet? What are the odds that Britain will join the common market in the next 5 years?
Well, of course, in the next five years, we shall have had another election in Britain, and we shall be back in power, and then the situation will have changed.
May I ask you, up to that election?
Up to that election? Well, I'm not a betting man myself, but I think the situation is really this, that if we are to become a member of the common market, Britain has to accept the common market as it is. It's much too late for us to try to alter the makeup of the common market itself, or its rules and regulations, broadly speaking, or its principles. If we had taken part in the coal and steel community, the Schuman Plan in 1950, we'd all have grown up together and developed together, and we'd all have had our part in influencing it. So this is the first thing, to accept it as it is.
Are you saying it depends more on Britain than on
that France? Stage depends entirely on Britain. The next stage depends on the community as a whole. I don't believe that they want to start negotiating until they have got the common market set up completely. And that means the 1st of July 1968, which is now 2 years away. So that part depends on them. And the third part depends on the President of France, as to whether he is prepared to have Britain as a member of the common market. And I believe that before we reach that position, the French want to see the question of the sterling indebtedness sorted out, because when we become a member of the community, the other members undertake certain obligations towards us in case of balance of payments trouble and so on. And he wants to know about the future defense and political arrangements for Europe.
Sounds now, like long odds.
Yes.
We have just about 2 minutes, Mr. Newman.
Mr. Heath, there's lately been great British influence among young people in Europe and in the United States in such things as clothes, music, length of hair, general outlook. Is that a superficial thing, or is it a sign of something deeper that the British are bringing about?
I think it's a sign of immense vitality. Of course, it hasn't all started from Britain. The Italians introduced a good many styles themselves, which were then taken up by the young British. As far as beat is concerned, I suppose we started it very largely and it spread into Europe. But surely what is interesting about it is that the youth of Europe is now mixing so much. I mean, when I was young, I was born by the coast, I always looked across the channel just by Dover, and I used to go across during holidays from school, I used to hitchhike and so on, but it wasn't done a great deal. But now it's taken as perfectly automatic, and you go across on a scooter or something, and the Germans are mixing so much with the French. This is the exciting thing.
Is it also a sign of change within Britain that the young people have a position they never had before?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's a different balance in society, and I think it's a very healthy thing.
What brought it about? The loss of colonies, perhaps? Does that have something to do with it?
I don't think directly, no. But I think that with the growth of education and with a much higher standard of living in the last 15 years, this has had its effect on youth. Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Heath, there are many observers here who believe that the British Commonwealth has outlived its usefulness. Do you think so?
No, I don't. I believe that there is still a part for the Commonwealth to play. And for this reason, we've got a common language. We've all had experience of British administration, for good or ill. There's a great deal in common between our law and legal systems, between the professions and so on. And this enables us to talk to each other the whole time, even when we have differences, as I don't believe any other countries can talk to each other, except perhaps Britain and the United States.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up.
In a moment, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of this week's Meet the Press interview.
This is Frank Blair. Just minutes from now, I'll be with the Sunday Evening Monitor and continued coverage of the big space story, the flight of Gemini 9. A disturbing story here on Earth recently has been the controversy over the drug LSD. This evening, we'll take a searching look at the subject. One of the people we talked with was Dr. Timothy Leary, who was dismissed from the staff of Harvard University because of his disputed LSD experiments. He described the effects of the drug.
The most typical reaction to an LSD session is religious. There are confrontations with the question, what is real and what am I here for? You learn so much about yourself during these moments of the LSD experience that it's shaking, shattering, frightening, awesome, and does lead most people to a sense of deep reverence.
There are those who feel more concern than reverence for LSD. Senator George Murphy testified before the Senate subcommittee hearing investigating LSD.
We know that young people under the influence of LSD have thrown themselves out of windows, jumped in front of moving traffic, stretched out on tracks in front of subway trains, walked into the ocean and drowned, rolled over cliffs under the delusion that they were stones.
LSD. Miracle drug or menace? A special report in addition to news, sports, and features on Sunday Evening Monitor. Join me, Frank Blair, in a matter of minutes.
For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to Merkel Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkel Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C. That's Box 2111, Washington, D.C. Do you plan to start saving one of these days? Well, how about today? Start by buying United States savings bonds. You won't miss the 63 cents a day it takes to buy a $25 Series E bond every month. And when your bonds mature, you'll get back $4 for every $3 you invested. When you invest in United States savings bonds, you're helping yourself and your country at the same time. Buy United States savings bonds, the star-spangled savings plan for all Americans. Meet the Press will be heard again next week with a special one-hour interview of six of the nation's leading mayors, those of New York, Los Angeles, Boston, Detroit, Atlanta, and New Haven. They'll be gathered in Dallas, Texas for the annual conference of mayors. Meet the Press will begin one half hour earlier than usual on most of these stations. But check your local radio listings for the exact time. Roger Bowman speaking. Gemini 9 continues to orbit the Earth. Follow its flight on NBC Radio and Television.